Hello, my name is Corey Rogers, and I'm honored to be Shelburne Museum's Francie and John Downing Senior Curator of American Art. Today, I am joined by artist, author, and curator David Bunn Martin, the great-grandson of Charles Sumner Bunn, the subject of our most recent online exhibition, In Plain Sight, Rediscovering Charles Sumner Bunn's Decoys, which can be viewed on the museum's website. Mr. Martin, thank you so much for joining us today. I hope that, you know, we'll have a very fruitful discussion.
Thank you very much, Corey, for the invitation. Looking forward.
So just to get started, I wanted to start with this book. Your book, Time and Memory, Oral Histories and Stories of a Family of Shinnecock Apache Indian Hungarian Ancestry. It was a really invaluable resource for our reattribution process. Can you tell us a little bit about why and how you went about collecting these intriguing stories about your family?
Well, I went away to school at the University of Oklahoma between 78 and 82. And my grandmother, the family owned a gift shop in Southampton for many years. My grandmother founded it in 1938. And it was a Native American arts and crafts store. And she was out there every summer, and I would come home, visit her during the summer season. And I spent a lot of time with her, you know, taking care of the public and so forth. And I'm an artist, so I did some painting and so forth, but I'd always thought about recording things. I had a cassette recorder, and I always knew that my grandmother had a very sharp memory and could recall many, many stories of her father, Charles Sumner Bunn. So I thought, what better way to capture some of that background than by recording on the cassette tapes, which is what I did for several years, beginning in the probably late 70s, early 80s, and I forget exactly when, but every few days I'd go and ask her questions for maybe an hour or two at the time. I did a little research to see a little bit about oral histories, and I wanted to capture as much detail as possible. So it wasn't only for myself, it was for the family, it was for the tribe. I was born and raised in Southampton, and we lived on the Shinnecock Reservation in Southampton. And I knew that after her time, if I hadn't recorded as much as she could recall, that a lot of that information would be lost. It wouldn't be many people that would know that those histories, because people from her generation were passing on and so forth. I didn't know. I knew as time went on, more and more, of course, passed on and didn't have that information at all. And my grandmother remembered a lot of detail. So that's how it came about. I recorded, I don't know, maybe 10 or 12 cassette recordings. I didn't do anything with them for years until maybe the beginning of 2000, year 2000. Didn't do anything with them. I put them away in the closet. I didn't have time, and I didn't have think about what to do with them. But around 2000, for some reason, I thought, well, I better do something with those recordings. Otherwise, I'm going to lose the detail. I'm going to lose the significance of what we did. She had passed away in 1992. My mother passed away in 98. She had quite a lot of information as well, but she was my grandmother, my father, my Uncle David, and my mother were the primary resources. And then when I did the larger, I did, as I showed you just before we started, I did a first version of the book. What I did was I transcribed the tapes verbatim, by hand writing out the text of each tape. I just wrote it out, played a little bit, stopped, wrote out what I could hear, played again, and then wrote out again what I could hear until it had a manuscript to it of some 600 pages. Then I tried to make it somewhat chronological. There were a lot of different subject matters involved. Tried to make sense out of it. Really didn't have much of an editor. I had a very good friend, Dr. John Strong, who was a former professor of American history and Native American history at Long Island University. He was kind of an editor, an informal editor and friend, and he was able to give me a a comment on the book, an impartial comment, well, you could say a scholar's comment, reaction to the book, which is really nice, because there is history there of significance, enormous amount of historical significance in the book, beyond the family, as I mentioned. And so also not only from my Charles Sumner Bunn, but his good friend, my grandmother, grandmother's husband, Charles Martin, who is Chiricahua Apache, and he had been raised a prisoner of war with Geronimo's band at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. So we have a lot of official history of the Chiricahua Apache tribe of Arizona in the book, as well as my great-grandfather, Shinnecock Montauk. And then my father was Hungarian. He was a Hungarian concert pianist from Budapest, and my mother was a classical singer. So the whole family is artistic, and that's basically it. I transcribed everything verbatim, so most of the material in the book is my grandmother speaking on first person, you might say. But it was really, it took me so many years to put it together. The first edition came out before this one, which is also available for sale. But the one reason I did this one was I had more material. I interviewed a couple more people. The oldest elder on the Shinnecock tribe is in there, who recalled my great-grandfather and told about how he worked, more of his hunting techniques, and then more documents, pictures that are a little clearer, easier to read. You know, the quality of the printing is better. So that's also why I did this version. Thank you.
It's a beautiful, beautiful book because it captures the wonderful history of a very complex family with great artistic abilities. And, you know, from the standpoint of a decoy historian, it was, if you hadn't recorded this information, we wouldn't be able to draw the connection between your great grandfather and the decoys in our collection. So it was just a wonderful resource for us. So thank you for doing that.
You're welcome.
Yep. So as we move forward, I'm just going to look at some slides here. And this is a picture of your great-grandfather, Charles Sumner Bunn, and his family. Can you help us identify everyone in the photo and sort of where was the photo taken?
Yes, the photo was taken at my great-grandfather's house and farm. If you get the book, I have a layout actually of the whole farm itself and where his workshop is located, what it looked like. The workshop, of course, burned down because he was a pipe smoker. My grandmother said he probably put his pipe down and it fell over and caught the shavings, and that's how he lost his workshop, which is in the backyard of the house where this picture was taken. And he also, interestingly enough, raised pigeons in the roof of his little workshop. So I have the actual design of the workshop, what it looked like, and also the layout of the farm. This picture was taken by an unknown photographer. We don't know who it was. This I acquired through my great aunt, my grandmother's sister had this photograph, which was in the family, I guess, for many, many years. Identifying left to right, you can see my great grandfather, Charles Sumner Bunn, 1865 to 1952. Next person in the right, to the right, is Della Felicia, my great aunt, 1904 to 1923. Marjorie Jeanette, 1907 to 58. Helen Smith Bunn, 1902 to 1993. Helen Bunn, she was still living with my grandmother, who was in the front row. She passed away in 1993, I believe, my grandmother in 1992. Then my great-grandmother, Maria Alice Smith Bunn, 1863 to 1955, on the right in the back row. She was from Virginia. We understood she was part Cherokee, white, black and white, mixed ethnicities. But she was, as I said, she was from Virginia, and she was really the extremely enterprising, a very interesting counterpoint, you might say, to my great-grandfather. First row on the left is my grandmother, Alice Osceola Bunn Martinez, 1901 to 1992. She's the one that whose information is primarily in the book itself. And then her sister, Dora Evelyn Bunn, 1899 to 1921. Some of the sisters died young because, you know, in the early 20th century, they, you know, they had illnesses and so forth that they didn't have, they weren't easily treatable like today. So that's one of the things that happened. They didn't, none of them had children except my own grandmother, which is me, primary, you know, it's only one. So, but anyway, and then, so that is who they were. And so this was taken probably in the 1920s, I would imagine. Yes, it's very, very early. And this could have been taken by a client of my great grandfather's. He knew a lot of people. It was taken around the same time as the other ones that you have there, the hunting client and so forth. So yeah. Hope that's helpful.
Wonderful, wonderful. So speaking of your grandmother, have you, you have so graciously shared a great wealth of family photos with us here. And here's a great example. Is it correct to say that your grandmother was the primary source of information about her father that you included in your book?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Without much more than anyone else, because she was a very honest person, very sharp memory, and she liked detail. She remembered detail. She liked history. She liked to read romantic stories of European history. She liked to keep track of, you know, even European royalty, believe it or not. She was fascinated by that. Maybe she got it from her father, who went to school at New Paltz Normal School, upstate New York. He studied the classics. He was very well educated, maybe even more so than many Native American people for that era, see? And so he enjoyed classic literature. Maybe that's how she got interested in not just, romantic fiction, historical fiction and so forth. So she had a good memory for dates and details pretty well, you know, and she remembered a lot of the things that we were all interested in today. And this is a picture I took of her here myself, probably in 1988, more or less, or 87. And that basket she's holding is, she learned basket making, which was one of the Shinnecock arts, of the Shinnecock Nation and Montauk Indian people of Long Island. Basket making was one of the traditional arts. She learned this from a cousin of hers. And that was made out of white oak and so forth. So I thought that would have been a good picture to get of her at that period. And so I hope that's helpful. But she, as I said, I recorded her at great length for hours. I didn't want to overtire her. So when she got tired, I stopped, but I always wanted to keep as much detail and fill in as many gaps as I could, especially about her great grandfather, who she remembered in detail, who many of his clients, you know, that a lot of those people that he knew, she knew. And I recorded a lot of those people in the book, as you see. So I have a few other tidbits for you about some people that can show you a little bit about the character of my great-grandfather too, and how he worked and so forth. But he was I think he was an extraordinary person, for whatever it was, his personality and his personality, I think almost more than anything else, must have attracted a lot of people to him. He was never a person that would take orders. His clients were the very high end socially, you know, in the United States, pretty much here and around Southampton area. And when they started coming out and he started working with them as a guide, hunting guide, they almost communicated as equals in a way, you know. He didn't, they didn't boss him around and tell him what to do. You know, he knew the history just as well as they did, you know, and he knew that he had the skill that they wanted, that they needed. So he wasn't afraid to interact with them, you know, very careful, very closely. And he had very good friends among many of them, very, very good friends. And so this is a wonderful picture of him here. I acquired a lot of these photographs. If you see the book, I have dozens of photographs that I think my grandmother and grandfather kept a lot of these things. They were fascinated by history, as I said, so they didn't dump out old pictures. They kept them. Some of the pictures weren't the best quality, but back in the 80s, I had them copied and reproduced to get the most clarity out of them that you could get. Because this picture right here is a tiny little thing. It's only 2 or 3 inches in size, maybe 2 inches by, maybe 2 by 3 inches at the most, you know. Probably taken from a Brownie camera, you know, the little old Brownie camera. My mother might have taken this for all I know. So this was taken on the porch of his house on the Shinnecock Reservation. He had, again, believe it or not, I have the layout of all of the floors of his house that my grandmother could recall. It's, I put it all in the book. And the house actually burned down, I think, unless this is the second house many years ago. But you can see his little dog. I guess it was a hunting dog that he used. I think they named him VJ, if I remember correctly. Victory in Japan, you know. And this is, I guess, is a typical picture of Charles Sumner Bunn on his best days, you know.
Yes. As a historian looking from the outside in, it's the personal stories that provide insights into the personality of the people that we're researching. And some of my favorite tidbits in your book are the fact that your great grandfather, like you said, loved to read, and he often quoted Shakespeare. And I also love that one of your great grandfather's acquaintances remembered that his laugh was similar to the ululation of a loon. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, that adds the different perspectives that you don't get just going through and reading, you know, family papers and looking at old photographs. So,
right. Well, he had a sense of humor. My grandmother had a sense of humor. She always recalled that he was not a strict, well, he was strict, I suppose, a certain degree, but the mother was strict. My great-grandmother was very strict, you could say, and almost in the Victorian sense. But my great-grandfather was very childlike, you know. He had a young way, I think, in his spirit, you know. He was young, and he had a wonderful sense of humor, a very warm person. And but he had a lot of strength too, you know. He had a lot of conviction about certain things as well. And everybody respected him, you know. The people here in the Shinnecock tribe respected him. He was the elder of the church, a former trustee of the tribe, of the nation that was reelected many, many times. And they looked on him as a historian as well. So, he had a lot of different qualities to him, but I think he was very comfortable. He was very secure. You know, he wasn't someone that was a nervous, stiff person. So, yeah.
Yeah, you can definitely get that sense of his character in these wonderful photographs. Mm-hmm. Charles Sumner Bunn was a renowned hunter, guide. He was a bayman and a farmer. Can you tell us a little bit more about his professional life?
Well, he... yes, he was, as I said, he knew many of the very wealthy people in the country, politicians, industrialists, lawyers, doctors, professional people who were living around the reservation. These were very wealthy people. My great-grandfather was raised hunting and fishing. He had a catboat. He took boating parties out. He just knew how to, every part of nature. That was a part of his heritage that came forward, you know, many years later. I don't know, I guess his father taught him carving, but we, as I said, we have an innate ability in the arts for different generations as well. His own father, David Walkus Bunn, was the first mate on several whaling ships. He drowned on the Secashion shipwreck in 1876 off Bridgehampton. And he did scrimshaw on shipboard. You know, this is back in the 1860s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. So he was a craftsman of the highest quality, if you ever saw. And he had used to make the heads of ebony canes with ivory. So my great-grandfather, he had this ability, I find, now that you have are able to identify his work. He has this lifelike quality in his carving. I think it was very unaffected, though. You know, it was just part of him that came out. And he was able to give the clients, you know, their money's worth. There was no other person that was as well respected and well known as he was for the quality of his work and for his knowledge and his ability to communicate with anyone, that including children, all the way up. And you can see that reading, looking at his business cards. I mean, he taught children firearms. You know, he worked with Kermit and Quentin Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt's sons. His own cousin, well, the distant cousin, was a nanny to Teddy Roosevelt when he was a young child, you know, up the island there. So there was an interaction very early on with these people in high society here, but they always gravitated to him and other members of the family, I guess, as well. His cousin was very well educated as well. She was a school teacher. They respected the family. And so a lot of these people gravitated to him, as I said. There were other Native American people, I realized, in New England especially, that were guides and took many people out hunting, you know, around the turn of the 20th century. There was, I'm thinking of a couple now that were up in Maine and so forth. They were Native American people as well, that knew the land, knew the behavior of the birds and the animals that they wanted. One of the interesting stories was he didn't know, he wasn't accustomed to big game hunting. And one of the stories my grandmother told was when he went to Bic, Nova Scotia with Dave Abercrombie, you know, of Abercrombie and Fitch, and a crew of them, a few buddies. And they just wanted him along. They liked him so much, they invited him to come on this hunting trip. And my grandmother said, well, you know, he wasn't really accustomed to hunting moose and bear, but they just wanted him there anyway. And he went along, and she remembered all the, what it was like at the campsite. You know, this is probably before 1920, maybe. I don't know. I have no idea now, but she remembered a guy named Lousy Lou G because he had lice, you know, and all these funny characters. And they just had a ball because they had him along, you know. And so, as I said, he knew all these people, Christian Herter, the Secretary of State, you know, Herman Rogers, who was knew Wally Windsor, you know, the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, and all these people that were had connections to Tuxedo Park, New York, Eastern Long Island here. There was another story my grandmother told of Adele Colgate, who was of the Colgate-Palmolive family. And she gave my great-grandfather a horse, a very, I don't know if it was a thoroughbred, but it was a very fancy horse that my grandmother said, well, you know, he had farm horses to work in the fields. He never had any thoroughbred horses or very fancy bred horses at all. But she thought so highly of him that she gave him the horse, you know. And I think if I'm not mistaken, it's the same horse. He eventually killed himself because he tied him. He was tied up and he walked around this where the tie was and strangled himself or something. Oh. It was very devastating, I guess, at the time. Those are some of the people he knew, you know. Another story with, he was the kind of person, though, as I mentioned, that was, he was very firm. He could be firm. He was a Christian person. He believed in his spirituality or religion very much. And he said he wasn't going to work on Sundays, you know. And a lot of these wealthy clients, they weren't maybe as spiritual or as religious as he was, you know. And I was just reviewing before we came on, it was one that my grandmother told, a little vignette where this man named James Lawrence came to the house. His sister married a famous polar Arctic explorer named Sir Hubert Wilkins. He was an Australian explorer. And so this James Lawrence, so this is the brother-in-law of Sir Hubert Wilkins. Anyway, he came to the house and he wanted my grandfather to go out with him on a Sunday. And he said he'd already told him that Sunday he goes to church, you know, he doesn't go out working on Sunday for anyone. And oh, he got a little mad, you know. He said, well, why don't you go? Come with me anyway, you know. And he says, he had to insist to him, you know, listen, son, I'm not going to go out today. I already told you I don't work on Sunday. You can take the birds if you want, and, you know, to go out and to shoot or whatever. But my grandmother said he never came back again, you know. So he lost a client there, I guess. But and also knew Beau Leroy Edgar, was a frequent client of my great-grandfather's. They went to Montauk Point many times. As that, as Joe Jansen said in his presentation, that my great-grandfather said the best hunting at that time was out at Montauk Point. He also went all around the Shinnecock Reservation as well. It was very good duck hunting and geese, snipe, and ducks and so forth. And anyway, they went out to Montauk, and my great-grandmother said that they went out hunting, and he said, well, what are you going to use for your decoys? You didn't bring them with you. And so he, without letting on what he would do, I guess, knew Beau Edgar. He went off a little ways by himself, and my great-grandfather made a whole lot of little decoys out of seaweed. And he fashioned them, you know, by hand, you know, and they worked just as well. He got birds. It reminded me of the world's oldest decoys, you know, that are Native American, out in Lovelock Cave in Nevada, which they're like 2,000-4,000 years old, you know. So our people always, they could improvise. He could do that, you know. He could call the birds without a whistle, you know. He just used his voice. So he knew all the tricks, you know, and he was one of the best shots probably in the world, as my Uncle David said, you know. It was no question. He was very, very good shot. So. Now this picture here, we're not sure who the client was. It's one of these wonderful pictures that I acquired, of course, many, many years after it was given to the family. And it's just a wonderful picture. I'd love to make a painting of this painting of this photograph sometime. And so that's about it.
That's wonderful. So the next photograph that we have is of your great-grandfather at the Sportsman Show in Madison Square Garden in 1906. And this photograph is really sort of the linchpin of the reattribution of Shelburne's decoys. Can you tell us what we're looking at here and how it sort of illustrates the story that your grandmother told about his participation in this event?
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, my grandmother told me about this many times. He would get to barrels full of decoys that he had carved all winter or whenever he would stock them up. And then he'd go on the train and go into New York City, you know, on the Long Island Railroad with barrels, I guess, full of birds, duck decoys. He also sold furs. They had fox, mink, a few other small mammals that he would trap as well, and also sold them on the commercial market. So in addition to, the birds, he also sold other things, other small mammal furs and so forth, skins as well. I guess he had a lot of contacts, knew a lot of clients. And this picture, again, it's so funny because it's almost so perfect. I mean, what more could you ask when you're trying to show the connection of the maker of something like this and his work, you know what I mean? I mean, what more do you need? You know, it's like you're being spoon-fed that the man carved the birds. He's sitting there. We also have that other picture that you're familiar with, of the more close-up portrait of him carving a bird, you know. So when Jamie Reason mentioned how he was able to put together the shape of these birds at a distance when he first saw it, he saw them and they were so small, the picture was so small, he was still able to make out the conformation of the shapes of the birds. And I was amazed myself, you know, what do I know? In the family, we didn't have many of his birds. We never knew to what extent he signed them and what extent he didn't sign them. My grandmother knew he carved. I think she was closest to Orson Munn Jr. Orson Munn Jr. and Sr., she always talked about as being very, very close friends of my great grandfather, and he was one of the ones that bought a lot of the birds from him and could substantiate the fact that he is the carver of the birds. So, but we didn't have many of his birds when growing up in the house. And I think the one or two that we have, he didn't sign.
Yeah.
We didn't know. We lost track after he died. You know, she didn't visit a lot of these people anymore unless they came into the family gift shop, which a lot of them did every summer. If they had a second home here in Southampton or East Hampton, you know, a lot of them lived in Tuxedo Park or other places up in Westchester County and would come out in the summer and would visit my grandmother and out in the family gift shop and say hello and, you know, talk about the old days or whatever. But that's how my grandmother kept in touch with a lot of people, if people who were former clients of her father. Really, it was Jamie Reason and Joe, first Jamie and then Joe, that I came to hear about and all the research they did many, many years later after my grandmother had died in 92. Then I thought, wowee, I was very amazed and very happily interested in the fact that there was a lot more information available than I knew about. There were more clients, more connections, more work, more birds out in the world that could be traced to my great grandfather. You know, I had no idea about. So that was very exciting for me, just to acquaint myself with the research, and then having this picture in order to, which had so much going for it. You know, in terms of what could be traced again back to his career. I mean, again, I come back to what more do you need? I mean, good grief, it's so clear, it's clear as a bell. She always talked about him going to the old Madison Square Garden, which is since destroyed, torn down, and that's where he went every year, you know. He was very, very enterprising and very sharp. You know, he knew a lot of people, I guess, and they placed many orders for him to do the work. So
that's wonderful. Mr. Martin, I hope you don't mind if I get personal here, but I'm just curious, what does the reattribution of Charles Sumner Bunce decoys mean to you and to your family?
Oh, I think it means an enormous amount. I'm a curator. I have a museum background. I'm an artist as well, art administration and so forth. I work for a nonprofit Native American arts, contemporary art organization. We work primarily in theater, visual arts, theater, media, and literary arts and contemporary Native American art. So Jamie Reason was actually able to put a lot of this in context, you know, in terms of the importance of in the Native American art area, you know, in a large sense, when the work came up at auction, a very high price. I have a cousin who's a very well-known sculptor, Native American sculptor, is on the top level of his career of Native American contemporary art. And to see my great-grandfather's work being categorized in the overall umbrella of contemporary Native American art at the top level is very, very exciting and very wonderful. I think back, I wish, 75, 80 years late is better late than never. I mean, my great grandfather passed away in 52. A lot of people knew what he did at the time, you know, but I guess as generations pass, people forget, you know, it's a different world today.
Yeah.
My grandmother knew, she knew all of his clients. A lot of them are in the book. She knew who they were and remembered a lot about their lives. But that connection we lost the connection. You know, when I'm not a hunter, I don't go out hunting ducks and things. A lot of people around here do. Interestingly enough, a lot of the people, local people, some of them who were are hunting today, I mean, they weren't all that excited about it. Some of the curators, some of the auction people, this and that. Some of them loved the idea. They thought it was tremendous. Others didn't care for it, you know. It's almost like, as we all know, I mean, in every field, there's politics, there's this, there's that, there's all kinds of reasons. I mean, it's like having people think that any famous artist, what happens if it's been misattributed for so many years, for generations, and then all of a sudden the attribution, it's found to be something different, you know, something maybe it should have happened a long time ago. But I think, so I just think back that my great-grandfather, he lived it. So I think, you know, that's one thing. My grandmother, I think, would have enjoyed this no end. I'm sorry she isn't here to experience this as well. As I said, she died in 92. She was so proud of her father, you know, and but she didn't, to see the impact of this and all of the content, the detail, I'm sure she would have enjoyed it immensely, you know. And so I think it's not only good for the family, you know, I'm really the last descendant on the main line, you know, I don't have children, and my other relatives are a little more distant, you know, in the family. We're all proud of it, of course, very, very proud of it, not just for the family, but for Native American art as a whole. The genre of contemporary Native American art. I mean, this is to have him join the ranks of other very, very well-known artists at a high level of quality, the highest level. It has enormous meaning, you know, contemporary Native American art, just in terms of recognition for the accomplishments of Native American people, is enormously impactful, enormously important, you know. So I'm very grateful for it. I'm grateful for the work of Jamie and Joe and the magazines who had the determination to print a lot of this material, whether people liked it or not. They made a decision and they went ahead with it and wrote a lot of good articles, published them. And also you, Corey, and your museum. I'm very grateful for your institution there at embracing all of this, you know. It's really wonderful. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
It's really a lot of fun, you know, and not just for the family, as I said, but for all Native American people, American Indians, so forth, whose histories, a lot of them, of course, are not recognized, are very little known, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
So this is also part of the excitement. Yeah. And so that's all part of it, you know. So
I just wanted to show this wonderful close-up view of your grandfather sitting in that photograph. And you're right, the silhouette of his decoys is so distinctive that once you sort of get a hint of it, you can see exactly what decoys we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And so that was really helpful in identifying the birds.
I was so interested. One of the articles, I think it was Jamie or somebody, had such a good analysis of the techniques that he used, how he carved them, made a hollow body, cut in half with the weights. It's very technical type of work. It wasn't just simplified. It was a lot of like technology put in there, you know, and then the whole shell is so, has so much life to it, you know, grace about the way it's carved.
The amount of work and detail that went into it and the prices that he was realizing for these birds at the time, you know, it's pretty shocking.
Yes. And so that was very interesting. My uncle David was a wood carver. His grandson, he passed away in 87. He was also a wood carver. Maybe he was influenced by his grandfather. And but he did miniature birds. He didn't do the working decoys. He did miniature decorative birds. That was maybe two-thirds, I think they were two-thirds scale, you know, in size. So he did a lot of birds like wood ducks flying with the wings extended. He did a whole series, all the guest rooms at the Silver Sands Motel in Greenport, Long Island. So he did all the guest rooms of this motel with pairs of birds, shorebirds in each room. And this was probably done back in the 50s or 60s, 1960s, you know. But he used airbrush, he used and everything. He didn't go into the minute, almost obsessive detail that some of the carvers use today, you know. But it was still very lifelike, like Charles Bunn's work, you know. It was so accurate, you know, accurate in form. And lifelike in shape, you know. It was just a different technique, a little bit in scale and so forth. But So we had two carvers in the family, but my great grandfather, wow, as we're finding, really set the standard. So, yeah.
Some of the most beautiful shorebird decoys, in my opinion, to ever be made. So,
wow, that's wonderful. Yeah, very exciting.
So we're sort of coming up to the end here, and I wanted to showcase your own work because, as you mentioned, artistic talent runs in your family. You are, in addition to being an author and a curator, you're also an accomplished artist. How has your family and its history influenced your work?
Well, my work, I've always been painting since high school, always been in the arts since probably 5, 6, 7 years old, drawing and painting, learned oils in high school, then went to the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe, New Mexico, got a BFA, Bachelor of Fine Arts at the University of Oklahoma in Norman, and then wound up getting an arts education degree at a master's at the Central State University in Edmond, Oklahoma. As I mentioned, we have connections to the West. So my grandfather was an Apache Indian from Arizona. He was raised at Fort Sill, Oklahoma as a prisoner of war. I've always loved to paint historical scenes, narrative scenes of the past, as well as portraits of contemporary people, whether they're deceased relatives or people that I get commissions for. I've done murals, I've done a lot of different scale things. My own technique is realistic narrative style. This particular one here is an acrylic piece based on the the famous Dixon expedition, Wanamaker expedition of 1913. Rodman Wanamaker was an industrialist, of course, but he went around many of the reservations at that time, taking photographs of a lot of the Native American people almost at the same time that Edward Curtis, the other photographer, was also taking photographs of Native Americans. So this painting is taken directly from a painting from the Wanamaker expedition. The original negative is at the Museum of Natural History in New York City. But I always love to colorize some of the old photographs of many of my ancestors, bring them to life, whether in oil. I use oil, acrylic, gouache, various media. So I always want, this is just fun to do at this time. I was doing a number of pieces in acrylic with this style, you know, and so I wanted to do one of my great grandfather in his prime. Again, this would have been 1913, and he, you know, so I really like the way this came out. And thank you for including it in the show, in the, you know, presentation. So yeah, that's basically it. This is one of my favorite pieces when he was still quite young here. Middle-aged probably, you know, and yeah, this is one of my favorite ones. I've colorized many of my ancestors, including his mother, Mary Emma Bunn. I have a lot of them either at the Shinnecock Nation Cultural Center and Museum. I have a lot of my artwork there. I recently completed a mural at the Southampton African American Museum, which just opened this past summer. They commissioned me to do a mural on the history of the African-American people of Southampton, New York, and the so-called Great Migration of people coming from the South, going north and coming into Eastern Long Island and so forth. So I was of great privilege to do that mural for a different cultural institution, you know, so, and thank you for asking.
You've been so generous with your time today. I have one last question. Is there anything else that you want us or our viewers to know about your great-grandfather, Charles Sumner Bunn?
I would say, I guess I always think more back to the type of person. My grandmother always liked to stress that he set the standard, I suppose, and his father, as being very ethical, moral type people, you know, very honest, but unaffected, you know. He wasn't It wasn't the type of person. It wasn't demanding. He had was well, good humored and everything, but he was just very cultured, very honest, and he was not a rough type of person. One of the interesting things my grandmother said when she asked her father, Charles Bonn, about his father, David Walkus Bonn, who was the first mate on whaling ships. You know, he sailed around the world, all over the world, with many on many ships, you know, hunting whales is a very tough way to live. And she says, what kind of a man was he? You know, because we always hear that sailors have to be very rough and tough and everything, and curse and all of this kind of thing in order to command men, because he didn't sail as a captain, but he was first mate, and I guess he had to be in charge many times, you know. And he said that her father said that, well, no, his father was not like that at all. He also was a kind of a cultured person. He was very firm. He thought his father said that a man wouldn't be much of a man if he had to resort to cursing every 5 seconds, you know, and in order to make his feelings known, you know, that's not a cultured way to be, you know. So I always thought about that in those terms, because it's so easy to, in this day and age, you know, everybody's cursing every 5 seconds, you know, and they think it's a great thing. And, you know, you don't need to do that. If you have can gain the respect and have, you know, that feeling that people want to work with you, you know, and respect you and everything, you don't need to resort to that. So I always think of those things about him, probably. That's the type of person he was. He was able to draw people to him because of his personality. You know, he didn't repel people. Lots of times, many people are talented. Many people have abilities, but they repel people. You know, they can't get along with anybody. That's the other half of life. You know, you've got to get along with people. And that's, I think, the kind of person he was, you know. So thanks for asking, though.
Wonderful. Well, Mr. Martin, thank you again for the generosity that you displayed when we were doing the research by allowing us to use photographs from your family's collection. And thank you so much for giving us your time today and your knowledge. This has been very, very helpful. And I know that everyone watching will enjoy it.
So, thank you. It's been a great privilege. Thanks again.